Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes feathers so special, and how did they evolve to serve so many functions for the world's birds? It's been 150 years since the first discovery of a feathered dinosaur fossil, the Archaeopteryx, and since then, scientists have continued to study and debate the development of feathers in modern birds and in their forebears. Conservation biologist and Switzer environmental fellow Tor Hansen is fascinated by the emerging discoveries and by the amazing properties of feathers themselves. He shares his enthusiasm in his new book, Feathers, The Evolution of a Natural Miracle. Tor, welcome to Think.
Well, thanks for having me, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
I have to hand it to you. Not too many delightful quests begin with zebra carcasses and vultures, but your story indeed begins there.
It does indeed. As a biologist, I've had a lot of odd field projects over the years, but studying vultures in Kenya got my hands pretty dirty, and the rest of me too. And it got me started thinking about feathers in an evolutionary context, because the vultures we were studying, of course, had lost the feathers on their heads, and it was a beautiful adaptation to their feeding habits.
Because they get really dirty when they're eating carrion.
That's right. That's right. If you're poking around neck deep inside a dead zebra, you don't want to have to worry about keeping something as complicated as a feather clean. It's much easier to have bare skin in that situation.
So we understand now that birds evolved from dinosaurs, but this was big news in 1861 when a quarry worker with a bad cough had the good fortune of finding a fossil.
That's right. This was in a place in Germany where these limestone quarries held some amazing fossils, and people had known about these fossils for years. The quarry workers had collected them, and the owners of the quarries had started to sell them to natural history collectors and museums. And this fellow found an odd fossil that he thought would probably be worth something, so he smuggled it out, and he used it to pay for medical service. Essentially, he traded it to a local doctor so that he could get treatment for his chest cold, and that doctor eventually sold it to the Natural History Museum in London.
What did Archaeopteryx look like?
Well, Archaeopteryx is a wonderful fossil, and I should say there are about 10 partial and full specimens that have been discovered so far. And the creature was, it was probably about the size of a starling or a magpie, and it was famously endowed as a fossil with the snout and the tail of a lizard and the great feathered wings of a bird. Hmm. So that combination of reptilian and avian features really ignited a firestorm, because this was right in the years following publication of Darwin's Origin of Species. And so to see what to Darwin's supporters was a clear link between these two groups of animals was really dynamite stuff.
Do we know for sure that Archaeopteryx could fly?
Could Archaeopteryx fly? Well, I have to preface my answer by telling you there have been over 1,000 research papers written about Archaeopteryx. Lots of argument over the years. It's a fossil people have started calling biology's Rosetta Stone because it's such a linchpin in evolution. But it does appear that Archaeopteryx could fly to some degree, to glide or fly to some degree. And you can tell by looking at the wing feathers, the primary feathers, that have definite aerodynamic qualities and very much resemble modern wing feathers. But other scientists have looked at it and said, well, it's looking at the scale of the bird and the amount of wing loading, it may not have been a great flyer, but it certainly had aerodynamic wings.
Why did it need feathers instead of just having sort of membrane wings in the same way that a bat does?
Oh, what a great question. Yes, if you look at the number of times that gliding or flight have evolved in nature, it's almost always been associated with membranes. Only within this dinosaur line leading to the birds do we see feathers used for flight. And it indicates to many people that feathers, the more primitive versions of feathers, evolved for other purposes. And they were there on these animals when they began to fly. or began to soar in some way, or leap, or use their wings for other aerodynamic purposes, and so the feathers then adapted for that purpose.
So in trying to understand how feathers evolved, there have been a lot of different theories. For a while, everybody was convinced that they must have somehow formed, starting with scales, and then they became quills, but that's it's fallen out of favor now.
It has. It's a great story. There's an ornithologist at Yale named Richard Prum, and he is behind this theory. He came up with this theory in a wonderful way, in my opinion. He was teaching at the time at the University of Kansas, preparing his lectures for his very first year of teaching ornithology. And he taught a course on how feathers grow. And then he was preparing a lecture, and he taught a course on this story of evolution of feathers from scales. And he said he realized at the blackboard, teaching his class, that it was absolutely impossible, that feathers and scales are so fundamentally different structurally and in the way they grow that they must have been on separate and distinct evolutionary paths.
So if feathers evolved initially for reasons other than flight, what did they do?
Oh, it's a wonderful question. So what Prum did was identify five or so stages that had to happen in evolution before you could build something as complicated as a modern feather. And those very first stages were simple quills, and simple quills divided then into filaments and fuzz. And so it looks as if those early stages may have been used for things like insulation, which, of course, feathers are still used for and are wonderfully adapted for. And it's also possible that those early feathers were used for display. They've even been able to distinguish what some of the colors of these fossilized feathers were.
How were they able to tell what the colors were, given that in many cases there may be fossils that have been found that indeed had feathers, but those feathers dissolved before they could be turned into fossils?
Oh, yeah, it's incredible. Finding a fossil feather is just a real rarity anyhow. For years and years, Archaeopteryx was one of the only fossil feathers to be looked at, and people argued about it back and forth. And then just recently, in the last 15 or 20 years, a trove of feathered fossils has been discovered in northeastern China, along with many other creatures, but a lot of feathered dinosaurs in the theropod line. And so what people have been doing, it's been done with at least two of those feathered dinosaurs now, is taking electron microscope images of cross-sections of those ancient fossilized feathers, and then comparing those to images of modern feathers. And they're looking for patterns of these molecules, or the remnants of molecules, called melanosomes, that are pigment molecules. Mm-hmm. And the pattern within those molecules just represents certain colors. And so by comparing the ancient ones to sort of a library of patterns from modern feathers, they can tell that the Cynocerapteryx was a ginger-colored feathered dinosaur, or that Anchiornis had a red crest and black and white wings.
So when you say theropod, those are the ones with the sort of claw-like feet, is that right?
The theropods are the meat-eating dinosaurs, by and large. There are some theropods that ate plants as well, but if you think of, Tyrannosaurus Rex, or the dastardly Velociraptor from Jurassic Park, those fleet-footed predators, those are the classic theropod dinosaurs.
They seem a little less scary if you imagine them covered with, downy red feathers or something.
That's true, although I think they were still quite fierce as predators.
Talk about the color thing, because we sort of see birds flying around and we assume that's just what their DNA tells them to look like. But in fact, for many species of birds, feather coloration has a lot to do with diet and with environment.
It does, yes. There are so many things to talk about with color, but if you think about how color is made in a feather, there are two primary ways. One is through pigments, and the pigments are often influenced by the diet of the bird. So if you have a flamingo in captivity, that reddish pink that colors the flamingo so distinctively is inherent in its natural food source, these little crustaceans, little shrimp-like creatures that it eats. So if you're not feeding it little shrimp, or if you're not giving it some sort of dye to supplement that shrimp, then in just a very few molts, it will start to fade, and eventually those feathers will look just plain white or not pink at all. So there are diet-based considerations, and then there are also structural colors in feathers, where it's not the pigment, but it's actually the structure of the surface of the feather and the way that refracts light back to your eyes. And so if when you see an iridescent look on a feather, that is from a structural color. And the two can work in combination so that you may have a pigment with a structural color over it, making a new color entirely, like the green in a parrot, for example, combines the yellow from pigments with a bluish structural color, and so our eyes perceive it as a shimmering green.
I love to read books that make me think about things I had never considered before, and this one is really a gem for that, including the fact that, okay, so throughout a bird's lifetime, the kinds of feathers that appear on its body may change several times, but they come from the same follicle. How is the bird's body able to sort of know when to produce this kind of feather and when to produce that kind?
Isn't that incredible? Yeah, it can change molt by molt what type of feather is produced right out of the same follicle. For many birds, the first feathers produced are what they call a natal down, the baby down. It's the fuzz that you see on a baby chicken. And if you watch then that same follicle producing the mature feather for a brief period of time, that little tiny down feather is still stuck to the end of the new feather. And that's why you see some birds that have recently fledged, robins and things out in the wild, that look a little fuzzy and funny when they're young. That's because they still have those other feathers on there. So simply through the signaling that the bird inherently gives to those follicles, it can change what they do molt by molt. And you may have, starting off with that fuzz and going to a mature feather, and then you may change the color of that feather and even the shape of it during the breeding season for the many birds that change color for attractive displays.
Why, Tor, are so many birds born naked? It would seem an instant advantage to have some down to keep warm when they're so skinny and little and fragile.
It depends. There are different strategies in birds. Of course, you have some birds that are born nearly ready to go. They're precocial, they say, and others that are what they call altricial, which are really not ready at all. And it has to do with a strategy from the parenting standpoint of how well hidden these birds are in their nest and whether it's more advantageous and more beneficial to get the bird out and hatched and immediately start feeding it and hiding it away there in a nest, or whether the bird is going to come out, say, for ground birds. They're often much more ready to go because they're going to be dashing about on the ground and they need to be able to survive the weather and protect themselves and start to forage.
My guest this hour is Tor Hansen. He's a conservation biologist and Switzer Environmental Fellow. We're talking this hour about his new book, Feathers, The Evolution of a Natural Miracle. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can get on the telephone line at 1-800-933-5372. Also, feel free to send email. The address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Tor Hansen. He's a conservation biologist and Switzer Environmental Fellow. His new book is called Feathers, The Evolution of a Natural Miracle. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So you mentioned before the break, Tor, that birds hatch at varying degrees of maturity and sort of readiness to survive alone in their environments. I did not realize that they also have differing responses to molting. Some of them are sort of incapacitated, and some of them do it just a little bit at a time.
Yeah, good question. So with feathers, they wear out, basically, and you need to replace them at certain stages. And the molting strategies really vary from species to species and from group to group. There are some birds that molt several times a year because their lifestyle demands it. If you think of, oh, a bird that lives in the grass, like the Virginia rail, they're dashing between the grass all the time, and that's constantly rubbing on their feathers, and they have more molts than the average bird because their feathers wear out. Similarly, birds suffer from, degrading feather lice and other parasites that can use up their feathers. So it depends on the life history of the bird, the strategy of the molt that then develops. Some birds will molt for the breeding season and then molt out of it immediately. Other birds will molt, you know, only once per year and just replacing the plumage with exactly the same color. For most birds, they will molt things sequentially, particularly on the wings, which are so crucial for flight or for diving birds as well, for swimming underwater. And they'll just molt one feather at a time from each wing. And you can even see this if you see a hawk soaring overhead. There may be a gap. There might be a mirror-like gap within each wing as one feather is being replaced, one or sometimes two. And that's so that they can continue to fly and not suffer a flightless period. Whereas there are some birds that decide to just get it over with, and there are some ducks and water birds that do this, ones that have a strategy to be able to avoid predators by swimming away across the surface of the water or hiding in the reeds. And those birds might lose their flight feathers right away, quite quickly, and just grow in a full new set.
And that's where we get the expression, because they can't get away from hunters, sitting ducks.
Sitting duck, yeah. If you trace the etymology of that phrase, a sitting duck, one that is in the midst of a molt and may not be able to fly or not fly well, those birds are sitting ducks for hunters.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Tor Hansen is my guest, author of the new book, Feathers, The Evolution of a Natural Miracle. Let's go on the phones now to Doug in Dallas. Hey, Doug.
Hi there, Chris. Hello, Mr. Hansen.
Hi, Doug.
Birds with their feathers have contributed very, very greatly to our literature because of the fact so much of the written word was done with quill pens. Have feathers always been hollow? And I'll take my answer off there.
Thanks for your call.
Oh, terrific, terrific question. It brings up two wonderful points. I'm going to approach the second part of it first, and that is, have they always been hollow? The answer is basically yes. If you look at a feather, it's inherently tubular in structure. And so there's some question in evolutionary thinking about when a feather is called a feather, those very early stages of feather development. But sometime very early on in feather development, that tubular structure developed. And so all the feathers on a bird now and for most of their evolutionary theory have been tubular and have had a hollow quill at the base. And to just echo your comment about the quill pens, they're just a marvel to study and to try to write with and to build. Quill pens are incredible things. They were the absolute pen of choice for 1,000 years, and there are many artists and calligraphers who continue to use them. I'll just pass along one note from the Queen's calligrapher, a man in England who's just a brilliant artist and is not only penning documents for the royals but also leading a team in doing the first quill-drawn, fully illuminated Bible in hundreds of years. And he told me this. He said that because a feather is so lightweight, when you drop it into your palm, you can hardly even feel it. He said, then as an artist or a calligrapher, there's no discernible weight to the instrument you're using. And so writing with a quill is more than any other thing that he's ever used. It's more like just simply an extension of the hand.
Hmm. I was surprised to read, though, that, you know, we see these line drawings of, like, Shakespeare or Cyrano de Bergerac, and they have these big, fluffy quills. And, in fact, people who had to use these things every day couldn't have been bothered with all that. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So, generally speaking, for people really writing a lot with quills, the vein of the feather or the big fluffy bit would just get in the way, and so that would be trimmed off. And, in fact, if you went to a calligraphy shop in London in the 19th century to buy quills, they'd be bundled in little boxes, and all of the vein part would have simply been cut off because it gets in the way.
How long would a quill pen last before it sort of, because it's like a fingernail, really, right? How long would it be till it broke down?
Well, they can last an amazing amount of time, write many, many pages, and in fact, some of the authors of the day would become extremely fond and perhaps even a little superstitious about their favorite quills, the ones that had written the best words, and sometimes they were framed and put on the wall at the end of a long writing project.
So we know from all the down jackets and down comforters that we have, at least in the dead of winter here in Dallas, Texas, that down keeps us really warm. Why is it so much better than anything we've been able to come up with on our own?
Oh, yeah, the insulating qualities of down are truly remarkable. If you look at birds that survive in cold climates, the tiny little golden-crowned kinglet keeps its body temperature very high. These are very warm little creatures, and yet they can do it on a night that's 30 below zero outside. So you can see as much as 140 degrees Fahrenheit difference between the body temperature of the bird and the outside air. And the success of down has to do with structure. It has to do with the fact that feathers branch and then branch again into these fine, fine filaments that create a huge amount of loft, capture a huge amount of air in that small space that the feather takes up. So when they're making synthetic insulation, it's an attempt really to mimic this kind of structure. And if you take apart synthetic insulation, you'll see it's a bunch of fine, fine filaments. But it's very difficult to build finely branching structures like that. And so synthetic insulation, while it's getting better, it still can't match the insulating qualities of fine goose and duck down.
So what about tropical birds that don't need anything to be any hotter than it already is?
Oh, yeah. Well, you can certainly see a variety in the amount of insulation that's on a bird, both by looking in the tropics versus the northern hemisphere, and even in northern areas, based on the season. They have much more down during the winter. But even in the tropics, birds need to be able to keep that high body temperature, you know, during the cool of the evening and overnight, or in rainstorms when things can get cold. So they have down feathers as well, and they benefit from the great insulating qualities of those feathers.
So at what point in our evolutionary history, or I should say it's not our history, in birds' evolutionary history, did feathers start to be associated with flight?
Oh, boy, now there's a question that could start arguments in all kinds of evolutionary meetings, but I think one of the best theories coming out about that recently has been from a fellow in Montana named Ken Dial. The challenge has been to try to figure out whether creatures started flying from the ground up, meaning they were dashing along and leaping after something and starting to use primitive wings to get into the air, or did they use the trees and come from the trees down, and the way creatures will leap out and try to glide for some distance. And it's always been there have been drawbacks to either side of that argument for years, and Ken was teaching again, he was teaching another great teaching story, but here he was teaching a graduate seminar, and he taught that lesson and pointed out the drawbacks, and his students said, well, why don't you come up with something better then? So what he did was set up a series of experiments to learn how baby partridges, chuckar partridges, fly. I mean, and what use to them is a half-grown wing, in a sense. This could mimic the way feathers and flight may have evolved together. And so what he learned was, in fact, they weren't just hopping from pedestal to pedestal the way he had predicted when he set up his experiment. But when he went away for a couple of days and left it in the charge of his young son, he came home and said, "How's it going?" His son said, "Well, they're cheating. They're just running right up the side of these pedestals. They're not hopping from pedestal to pedestal." And what they discovered was that young birds, young chuck-R partridges, and now many other species as well, use their growing wings for aerodynamic purposes by flapping with wings to create traction when they run up surfaces. They can run up a 90-degree surface and sometimes even beyond 90 degrees by using huge amounts of aerodynamic effort to give themselves better traction. It's the same way that race cars use fins on the back to help push their wheels down. If you look at a Formula One racer, it has a huge fin on the back. Well, that's creating pressure downward to give the car better traction. Birds do the same thing with their growing wings.
So it wasn't from the ground up or from trees down. It was something in between.
It's kind of in between. His theory really starts to take on a lot of explanatory power when you think that it gets birds using the increments of evolving aerodynamic wings in a successful way, because even a half-grown wing gives you better traction. And it also helps birds get up onto things from which they need to leap down again, and it helps explain the origin of flapping flight. There are many creatures that may glide by holding their wings or arms or limbs or membranes rigid, but very few creatures that have evolved flapping flight. And so this gives you the origin of flapping, and it gets you up on something to leap down from.
So we have a fair number of flightless birds still around today, but we don't have any feathered reptiles. When did the split happen?
Oh, yeah. So the split is quite early on, and that's why you don't see any feathered reptiles around. Now, it's possible, and some paleontologists believe now, that perhaps the very first increments of feather development may have come and gone several times in evolutionary time back throughout the history of the dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. But it's only, and perhaps I should say even the archosaurs, those predated dinosaurs, but it's only in this one line of fairly advanced dinosaurs, the theropods, that all of the steps necessary to build complex modern feathers took place and then became, if you will, sort of stable, evolutionarily speaking, within that line and led directly to birds. So the split was very early on, and the modern reptiles that we have are not feathered.
Is there any good reason? I mean, obviously, penguins use their wings when they're swimming. Why do ostriches still have wings?
Oh, why do ostriches have wings? Wonderful question. Well, they have wings, but what's interesting about their wings is to take a close look at the feathers on their wings, because the flight feathers of most birds, of flying birds, are specifically designed like little airfoils. The rachis, or the central shaft, is offset. It's asymmetrical. That helps them function together with the other feathers to create one airfoil, and also individually gives them aerodynamic properties. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the wing feathers of an ostrich, the rachis goes straight down the center, and the veins of the feather are not even solid. They're much more flowing and poofy, if you will, and that they have done away with the flight adaptations, and they have redesigned themselves to be very showy for displays.
Of course, maybe the ultimate display bird is the peacock, but the peahen is nothing special to look at least compared with the guys. And that has to do with her protecting her babies?
Yeah, in a sense it does. If you look at the most dramatic displays in birds and all these wonderful vivid colors, in many cases you'll see that the female bird, not always, but very often, the female bird is much less brilliantly adorned. And that makes evolutionary sense, too, if you think about the fact that the female will be most likely sitting on a nest for some period of time, having to stay hidden, or making trips back and forth to that nest, and again, where camouflage is much more important than display. And in fact, if you simply look through your field guide, you'll see a lot of birds that are drab in color, the little brown jobs, as they say. And that, again, gives you the some hint of the importance of camouflage.
Yeah, I think a great example is, you know, we have some cardinals that come to our yard every year, and the men are so bright, or the males are so bright, and the females just have that orange beak, but the rest of them is all brown.
Absolutely, absolutely, to blend in.
So if birds are evolving, I mean, are they continuing to evolve in different ways? Are we able to tell from recent history what changes have taken place in the last couple of thousand years?
Oh, what a marvelous question. Well, yes, evolution is not static, and you see things that, like feathers, may become stable to a large degree over evolutionary time because they're very well adapted. So the changes that may come along through mutation or other means don't tend to last very long because it's really a beautifully adapted thing through a long period of evolutionary time. But that's not to say that there aren't things that in specific circumstances become quite useful. So new feather evolution tricks, for example, there's a wonderful example from a group of birds called the desert sand grouse, where they needed to be able to transport water over these arid places that they live from watering holes back to the nest. And the males, in that case, developed breast feathers that can hold more water than a dish sponge. So when Papa sand grouse comes home from the watering hole, the chicks dash out and drink directly from his breast.
Hmm. That really is remarkable. And there are no other birds that do that, as far as we know?
Just in the sand grouse. For most birds, the feathers are specifically adapted along, you know, the outer contour feathers and whatnot are adapted to be waterproof. So this is quite a change that at least during the breeding season, male desert sand grouse collect water.
Tor Hansen is my guest. He's a Switzer Environmental Fellow and conservation biologist. His new book is called Feathers, The Evolution of a Natural Miracle. Join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is conservation biologist Tor Hansen. He's a Switzer Environmental Fellow and author of the new book Feathers, The Evolution of a Natural Miracle. Join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. So, Tor, clearly feathers have a great deal of importance to the creatures that own and grow them, but they've also been a significant human commodity over the years. Can you talk about that?
Oh, absolutely. It never ceases to amaze me, but perhaps the most surprising aspect of the research for this book to me was the depth and breadth of the human fascination with feathers. It's gone on for thousands and thousands of years, from using them for very practical and intuitive things like the fletching on an arrow, mm-hmm. to quill pens, to using them to stuff our pillows and what have you, to using them for adornment, using them really in much the same way that birds might use them for display.
There's a new thing at my hair salon where you can get hair extensions that include real feathers. Have you seen that?
This is a craze that is coming about much to the ire of fishermen across this country, because these are the feathers that are used to tie flies. And so where fly fishermen a year ago could buy a full cape of prime rooster hackle for about $100 or $150, that costs more than $1,000 today, if you can even find one to buy. They're all being snapped up by hair salons across the country. And if you can't find them at your hair salon and want to see what it looks like, you just have to tune into American Idol, where Steven Tyler wears these things in his hair all the time.
Well, luckily these trends never last long, so the supply should come back for fishermen pretty soon. I guess in the interest of doing all the research you possibly could, you spent a little time with Las Vegas showgirls.
I did, yes. I traveled to Las Vegas to meet the costume designers and showgirls at one of the big Las Vegas reviews. And I was struck, really amazed, by how similar the display, if you will, of that show resembled, in this case, for one of the numbers, the Birds of Paradise, the greater and lesser Birds of Paradise, and they're the males' displays. There's phenomenal similarity, not only in color, but in the overall display of all these people on the stage. It was incredible. And one of the showgirls said something to me that is just quite profound if you think about how people and also birds use feathers in display. She said to me, well, she said, if you don't have enough swish, nobody looks at you. But too much swish, and your costume falls off. And so for a bird, they too are looking for the right amount of swish to gain attention from the opposite sex.
Yeah, but they don't want to be incapacitated if they have to flee from a predator.
That's exactly right. Too much swish, and it could actually be a detriment to the bird.
I was surprised that dyeing a feather is not a simple thing to do.
Not simple at all. No, feather dyeing is highly proprietary. The people who know how to do it hold those secrets very close to their chest. They need to first remove pigment from the feathers and then replace it with something else. And so feathers that can be dyed are and changed in color are the pigment-based feathers. What's interesting is that the structural colors, of course, can't be changed because the structure is inherent in the surface the surface part of that feather.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have an iridescent band on a feather that is otherwise colored, you can maybe take out the pigments and replace them with pink or bright blue or green, but it will always have that iridescent band because you can't change the structure.
Should we think about not buying feathers? Does it always involve killing an animal, or are they used typically for something else as well? Like, are we eating the birds that also have feathers sold?
Good question. The ethics of feathers. Well, the vast, vast majority of feathers that one would buy either in your pillow, in your ski parka, or if you were buying feathers for crafts or costumes or art, those are byproducts from the meat industry. And so those feathers are from birds that are being killed for consumption, and the feathers then are used for other purposes. Where you get into some trickiness with the ethics of feathers would be in buying feathers for particular projects. Like, in some cases, there are collectors who want replicas of old fly fishing patterns. And some of those old patterns, of course, were made with feathers from what are very rare birds now. And so there is a market, a black market, if you will, for collecting feathers from wild birds in the tropics that go into either fly fishing patterns or, in some cases, art projects or replicas of indigenous art, that kind of thing. And those things are to be avoided, because you can get colored feathers that are colored by dyes in other ways that will suit those purposes, and there's really no need to be collecting from the wild any longer.
You make the interesting point in the book that at least goose and chicken and duck feathers, in many cases, the feathers supply has very little to do with the demand.
It's a very peculiar market, really, in that typically the demand for a product will determine how much supply is there. But they're distinctly different for feathers in that the supply is determined by how much meat is being eaten, because people aren't simply killing birds for their feathers. They're killing them for the meat products, and the feathers are a byproduct of that. So it's a very peculiar industry in that way, particularly for those who work with down feathers for pillows and parkas and sleeping bags and what have you. Most of what they are using comes from birds from Asia, where ducks and geese are popular in the diet. And if people are eating a lot of ducks and geese in a particular year, there are a lot of feathers available. But even if you have a great demand for sleeping bags, if people aren't hungry for ducks and geese, you're going to have a shortage of feathers.
And if those birds are slaughtered, say, like when there's a bird flu outbreak or something, are the feathers destroyed as well?
I believe they are. I don't know for a fact, but it's my understanding that the birds are simply destroyed completely.
Is there any reason, if my kids find a feather on the ground, that they shouldn't pick it up and play with it?
Oh, and from a health standpoint, not particularly, but it should be noted that feathers are protected for the vast majority of species by the Migratory Bird Act of 1918.
Hmm.
And so we're not really allowed to collect feathers without a permit.
So as part of your research, you looked at a wren that I guess you'd found dead in your yard or somewhere. Can you talk about that experience and what you learned? I mean, you're a biologist, but the actual experience of sort of plucking it and looking individually at the feathers taught you things that you hadn't fully appreciated before.
Oh, absolutely. I'm very much a hands-on field biologist, and I realized that I needed to in a sense, disassemble a bird to get my head around what the feathers really meant to this animal. And I'll preface it by saying that I do have permits for this kind of work, and that that's a necessary step in the process of studying feathers. But this little wren was a roadkill, and so what I did was simply I decided I'm going to take this thing apart and count all the feathers and try to separate them into the different feather types. And it taught me a whole number of things about how that bird was put together and how the feathers, even after death, are held tightly in that follicle by all the muscles that control them, and how feathers grow in particular tracts along a bird. They're not simply distributed evenly across the body, but they grow in particular tracts and then are spread from there. And simply learn to appreciate the number of feathers and diversity of types on a bird, from the tiniest little bristles around the eyes to the wing feathers and the down, and thousands of feathers even on a tiny bird like that.
And some birds can actually move their feathers?
Yes. Not the birds in general have the ability to adjust the feathers. They're held into those in follicles with muscles, and they have the ability to adjust them. And the best way to see this is to watch a bird in flight, or to look at photographs, if you will, of a bird landing or taking off, and seeing how the feathers are splayed apart in certain ways to control the airflow around those wings. It's just marvelous. Or think of a bird fluffing itself up at night to stay warm, or contracting its feathers during the daytime. They have quite a lot of control, individual control over those.
Well, you talk about them changing their wing feathers in flight, and of course we've all seen this as a sort of biomimicry if we've ridden on a jet. Talk about the research into putting something like a synthetic feather onto jet wings.
This is really interesting stuff, but there's also already an example that you can see on many jets. If you look out now at the end of the wing, oftentimes you'll see a small fin sticking up in the air,
mm-hmm.
and that was inspired in part by the way birds, and raptors particularly, splay their wing feathers at the tips so that they can, in a sense, reduce drag. It changes the airflow and the turbulence around the wingtips, and that has led to great efficiencies for airplanes. Similarly, there are several research groups looking at the way feathers and the movement of feathers and the surface roughness of feathers alters airflow around the wing, disrupting turbulence and reducing drag.
Hmm.
And there's a real effort underway to see if that could be scaled up in some possible way to use that on jets. I mean, so it's entirely possible, if that's successful, that we might look out and see some kind of fuzzy surface on a jet wing, and that would be as a direct result of what we've learned from the bird.
We have an email here from Anthony who wants to know about hummingbird feathers. He asks, are they different since the bird is able to hover and fly backwards?
Oh, wonderful question. They are. The feathers are structurally the same, and the ability, the incredible ability of hummingbirds to hover like that has to do with how they use their wings, essentially, are pretty much in a figure eight sort of a pattern when they're flying. But the feathers themselves share the same aerodynamic qualities of other wing feathers and other birds.
So for those of us who are not birders as hobbies, how can we look more closely at the birds around us and appreciate them better?
Oh, I encourage everyone to take a look at feathers in the birds, to appreciate them. It's very helpful to spend some time with birds that you can see up close or with photographs of birds, and mm-hmm. this will help you appreciate their feathers. You know, people tell me, what can I possibly learn from a pigeon in the park? Well, get, you know, there's a bird you can actually see, or a duck that's eating breadcrumbs. And you can see the iridescence in the feathers. You can start to appreciate the difference between pigments and structural colors. You can watch the bird take off and watch very carefully how the feathers are splayed in flight and how that changes when they're soaring versus landing or taking off. You can even hear in many pigeons, for example, the wings flapping, snapping together, the feathers snapping together at the bottom of the wing stroke. So there are a lot of things, even in very common birds, that we can tune into and see. And you can even appreciate it in your own home. If next time a feather poofs out of your pillow or your comforter, take a good look at it and see the complexity of that structure. If you have a magnifying glass, look at it and see how finely divided those barbs and branch those barbs and barbules are, which will be an indication to you of what wonderful insulation they are and just why they're in your comforter in the first place.
Speaking of the sound of bird wings, there are some, we think of birds as singing, but there are some who actually play a sort of cricket-like violin.
Oh, it's a species of bird. It's one of my favorites. I've never seen one, but I would love to do so someday. The club-winged manakin. This was a real treat in my research to come across this story. But there's an extraordinary scientist at Cornell named Kim Bostwick who has sorted out what is going on in this bird that has mystified people since Darwin wrote about it in the 1870s. Very oddly shaped wing feathers, and the bird essentially is playing its feathers like a violin. The feathers are specially adapted so that when it knocks its wings together, it puts one feather with a bit of a pick or a hook on it. It sets that to rubbing across special ridges on an adjacent feather. And then the shaft of the feather, the calamus, or the quill part, is specially enlarged and resonates like the body of a stringed instrument. And it makes a pure and dulcet tone that this male club-winged manakin uses as part of its breeding display.
In the last couple seconds, do you find even vultures beautiful?
Absolutely. I have a great fondness for vultures. I'm not sure I would necessarily invite one to a potluck. They have some unsavory habits as well, but they're wonderfully beautiful creatures. Just watch them fly.
Tor Hansen is a conservation biologist and a Switzer Environmental Fellow. His new book is called Feathers, The Evolution of a Natural Miracle. Tor, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, thank you very much, Chris. The pleasure has been mine.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.